So what I want to do is to partly share a little bit of what I've been doing, so to speak, by exploring a theme that I've been looking at a lot for, particularly for the last 2.5 months. And this came particularly out of a retreat that I did for the entire month of February. One of the reasons I haven't been with everyone is that I was on retreat in February, and much of the retreat I was letting go of all meditation techniques, actually all practices, and yet was doing, so to speak, 7 or 8 hours a day of formal practice, but it was all and bringing the qualities of awareness and practice into my activities into the rest of the day. And one way that I've come to talk about this in the last few months is to explore the relationship, both in meditation and in daily life, of what we might call doing and not doing, acting and not acting. And so, what I'd like to do today, so to speak, and I keep finding myself talking about what I'd want to do today, and I did a 1 month retreat and so forth. What I'd like to explore is the nature of doing linked to themes of wise effort, skillful action in our meditation, and themes of non-doing, also very crucial in our daily lives, in our meditation practice. We use different words to get at these themes. Sometimes we might talk about doing and being, or acting and not acting. So I want to explore first the nature of doing an effort in meditation, especially, and but also pointing to the way we can use those themes in daily life. Secondly, look at the importance of what we might call not doing in our meditation and our daily lives. And particularly then in a third part, identify how we might inquire into an aspect, we might say, of the self that we can call the doer. Many of us have the conditioning to be a doer, so to speak. I find myself saying, so to speak, quite often. That's because the language is sometimes, in a way, in tension with the message, which is interesting. But that many of us have a very conditioned doer and, so to speak, have done quite well with our doers. Some of us may be gainfully retired because of a career of skillful doing that set oneself up in a good way. But we can still, even maybe if for some of us there is something like retirement, you can still notice the conditioning about doing. It might manifest in loss of meaning at times, or relative loss of meaning. I am not, quote unquote, doing what I've done for so many years. And I can see that in some ways, my identity is at stake. Who am I if I'm not the previous doer? And so, third part, I want to look into ways of investigating the doer. And then lastly, I want to point, I'll do it briefly today and in more depth next week, point to, I believe, where practice is going. That mature practice is an expression of a kind of doing that comes out of non-doing. Again, we can use language in various ways, and we can find this in the depths of many traditions. I'll particularly point to several dimensions of Buddhist tradition and also what we find in the work of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu in the Taoist tradition, where many of you know there's a very famous teaching called Wu Wei, which is a teaching about non-doing, as it's sometimes translated, or non-action, more commonly translated, as not just the expression of mature practice, but actually the core nature of all of being. So that's the trajectory. And what I'd like to do is to suggest, in looking at these different themes, practices that we might do in the next week, if you feel called, that can explore the territory. And I was reflecting that I once saw graffiti when I was in college. In my dorm bathroom, it was written on one of the bathroom stalls, a quick way of resolving all of these issues. So if you want the short version, this may work for you. See, so this was in the graffiti, there were three lines. It said, Jean-Paul Sartre, colon, to be is to do. Next line, Nietzsche. To do is to be. Next line, Frank Sinatra, dooby dooby doo. So that may serve as a resolution of the issue for many of us, but it's pointing in a certain direction. So I experienced that in college. Anyway, so here we go. So first of all, it's really clear that a certain amount of doing and skillful action, skillful effort is crucial in meditation and in virtually all parts of our lives. And we find this message very, very central in the teachings of the Buddha in a few different ways. One translation of the final words of the Buddha goes like this: all things are impermanent. Work out your practice with diligence. So this theme of the importance of continual practice, continual intentionality, what's going on right now? How can I skillfully practice? Very, very crucial dimension. And it's not easy. How do we have that level of continual intentionality in our daily lives when we get very distracted? How do we have it in our formal meditation? And so this is very, very clearly central to our practice. And for many of us, one of our edges may be to be much more intentional during the day. Might do that in various ways. It's one of the themes that we'll look at in that day-long retreat in June on deepening daily life practice. One of the ways to deepen daily life practice is to remember that there is daily life practice, It goes back to that theme that many of you have heard, that the hardest aspect of practice isn't practice, but it's remembering to practice, right? And so having more intentionality, having, you know, I learned from one of my students, you know, just a very simple something any of us could have thought of. But, you know, one of my edges is to keep a sense of awareness when I'm on the computer. How many can relate to that? You know, that's not easy, right? And so one of my students, who's a therapist, he said when he works with people these days on Zoom, he puts on his a little post-it on his computer screen that says whole body awareness. That's one of his core practices. And, you know, I've been trying various things, and, you know, in terms of being on the computer, and I recently just put that sticky on. You know, that hadn't occurred to me. I've used other things, like having, you know, a program that rings a bell every 5 minutes when I'm on the computer. You know, there are all sorts of things. So clearly there is a very, very central place for doing, for wise effort. We know that wise effort is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, right? It's emphasized. And skillful effort is especially, you know, at the four dimensions of wise effort. Some of you may have heard talks on this or studied it. The four dimensions of wise effort really boil down to the first is more or less stay out of trouble, stay out of unskillful ways of being. The second is know what to do if you get in trouble, if you have unskillful mind states arise, and so forth. The third is develop good qualities. And the fourth is keep them going. These are all, we might say, forms of doing. They involve intentionality. They are very, very central. You know, and for many of us, there that's, you know, that our even our sense of practice gets on our to-do list. It might be that for some of us at certain times, it might be, I need to do my practice. So I make a commitment to whatever, 30 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever. And for how many people does meditation go on your to-do list? On your daily to-do list, right? And so again, that's significant, that's important. Or it might be, I need to quote unquote, do a retreat every year or every few months or whatever it is. And so clearly doing is important and central. But so what I'll be pointing to the rest of the time is the importance of balancing out that doing with aspects of non-doing, and also see ways that we can be caught in doing, that doing comes to be something we identify with, almost becomes part of the structure of ourselves, and something we can unpack and look at. So I'll explore the rest of the time with the understanding and assumption that doing and effort and skillful action are crucial for our practice. And it's not all there is. Okay? So that's sort of the framing. And less obvious is the importance of not doing in our practice. And I would say in daily life. But when we look carefully, we can see that practice in many ways is a kind of progression in which we learn to do less. Initially, for many of us, this is very true for me, the first aspect of non-doing involves a kind of letting go of thinking. And in using the phrase letting go, we can see a theme that's very linked to the theme of non-doing. But we learn how to not be preoccupied by thinking. When I was first meditating, I was in my kind of early middle 20s, and I was a student, and I was thinking much of the day. And in the retreats, I, you know, especially when I started retreats, I had to learn to let go of the thinking and in a way come back to a more receptive dimension. And, you know, being a philosophy student, I really got into thinking about going beyond thinking, right? And all the ways that letting go works and non-think, you know, one can think a lot about non-thinking. Very interesting. And so, that's for many of us an initial way in which we let go. So probably if we look to the different dimensions of letting go, we also see different dimensions of not doing. So again, initial one would be letting go of thinking, sort of renouncing or engaging in renunciation related to thinking. I also mentioned that it really is necessary to learn how to be more receptive. Can I be more receptive with the breath? Can I be more receptive with emotions that are occurring and not try to control them? Again, very early learning for most of us, learning how to be more receptive to let go of a certain amount of doing. And in fact, one way we can really understand mindfulness in general is to understand mindfulness as requiring both a doing and a not doing. The doing is the connecting with the object. Let me connect with the breath. That takes effort. That takes a doing. Let me name what's going on in my experience. That's a kind of a doing. And there's also the letting go of that more active dimension of mindfulness and just being receptive to the sensations of the breath, receptive to the sensations of the body, receptive to the flow of emotions, and so forth. And this can take some time if we have a very active or overly energetic or overly effortful approach to meditation. And I find this in a number of people I work with, that, and I think this is very true of my own experience. I was very involved as a doer. Part of my talk today comes directly out of my own experience and ways I got stuck. You know, I remember one retreat where I was doing a concentration practice. This was about 30 years ago. And I was doing concentration practice for a week. It was part of a 3-month retreat. And I got really into it and really basically over-efforted. And I actually, I think, blew an energetic fuse from the over-efforting. And I actually had to relax for the next 2 or 3 years. And I couldn't even try to concentrate. I had to let my concentration come without effort, because every time I concentrated, even initially, when I would look at a traffic light, I would get a headache, my head would hurt. And so I could see immediately what was happening, that I needed to let go and let my relaxation and concentration come without any doing, which happened. But it came out, you know, I could see that coming out of an overdoing, which I do find in some of the people I work with. And so having, you know, developing that more receptive dimension is really crucial. And we have a lot of metaphors from the Buddha. You know, he talks about having your mind be like a lute that's neither too tight nor too loose, right? Probably all of us, how many have heard that one? That's probably very, very common. There's a passage where the Buddha is asked, "How, sir, did you cross the flood?" The flood being the whole process of being stuck, of having being caught in dukkha, in ignorance and suffering. And the Buddha's answer points to this kind of balance. "Without tarrying, friend, and without hurrying, did I cross the flood? How did you, without tarrying, without hurrying, cross the flood? When I tarried, I sank. When I hurried, I was swept away. And so, untarrying and unhurrying, did I cross the flood?" I think it's pointing to that balance, we might say, of being active and being receptive. It's very, 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 very crucial. So, this opening to receptivity is not so easy. The opening to the balance of doing and not doing is not always so easy because many of us have very strong conditioning to be doers. Again, I think I certainly have had that conditioning in the month of February when I was doing this retreat. Again, the language is humorous. When I was on retreat and inviting pretty full and total non-doing in the meditation, I noticed I was coming up almost against something like a limiting belief. I need to be doing something in meditation, or it's not going to work. And I could see that, even though, for years and decades, I've explored receptivity and explored a lot of different practices that are essentially practices of letting go. But I could see that there still was, at times, that kind of limiting belief. And again, many of us can see that in daily life, in our, if that some of us are away from the usual doing, we might feel confused. How many people have been on vacation when there was nothing to do and got nervous or found some confusion, right? Yeah. That's quite common. It also could be, again, I mentioned some people might retire and a lot comes up around not being, so to speak, a doer anymore. How many have had something like that come up in some way? What am I doing? Who am I if I'm not a doer? And maybe we can talk later about other ways that occurs, or being busy. Interestingly, some of you may know, I think I quoted this before. The Japanese or the Japanese term that translates as being busy is the heart dies or the soul dies. And so this busyness, and I can find in myself sometimes, I think it's a lot of this is very, very cultural, that we can notice ways that we just want to get this done, get that done. Sometimes I joke that many of us would rather complete our to-do list than reach awakening. For how many people is that true? Okay. Many would rather complete the to-do list than have enlightenment, if you're really honest with yourself, right? And so very, very interesting. And so I've noticed sometimes on retreats where there's nothing to do except be aware. And I might, I think I especially notice this. I take, maybe take a walk after breakfast and I sit on the bench. And occasionally on retreats, I've noticed myself feeling, okay, got to do something. And I actually hear the message, no rushing, don't rush, and just have to let go of that tendency to want to get to this, to get to that, to do these things. So there are a lot of ways that we can really look at our tendency to do. And this is part of what I want to invite next week, in the next week, if you care to explore this. You can explore doing in meditation, as I was mentioning. How much is the doing really important and really crucial? And how much is that still something I need to develop further? But then also, where is the not doing in my meditation? Can I be truly receptive, truly open, and not trying to manipulate my sensations, my emotions, my thoughts, just let them occur? And then we can look at all the various ways that we might be caught by the doer, tendency to rush, tendency to maybe get a little nervous when there's nothing to do, and where am I, and, or whatever, it's a Sunday afternoon, and Marin Sangha is 3 hours away. What should I do? Ah, I don't know. But to look at that, to see where we get caught, or to see how much we have this sense of, I have to do this. I have to do this to finish this project. So I get to what? So I get to really relax, get to ease, and do what I really want to. But then when we get there, sometimes we're tired or exhausted. We've spent so much time in doing to get to somewhere else. But then when we get to somewhere else, it's actually not where we want it to go. That's sometimes true in terms of working for one's whole life to get somewhere. And then when one forgets where one was wanting to go. So the invitation is to look at how that manifests in your life. Try to, maybe have an intention once or twice a day. Let me investigate the doer when the doer appears. And it's more the sense of, I am a doer, or I need to do this. And, as we'll see, we can be active in the middle of activities and not necessarily be caught up with the doer. So to see where there's anxiety or fear about open time, open space, non-doing. My friend and colleague, David Loy, writes very interestingly about the nature of the self in Buddhist teachings, is that there actually isn't really any substantial self. So he talks about the self as a lack. The self is empty, and we put a lot of effort into filling it up. Being a doer is one of the ways we do that. One way that we can work with this is to follow what one of my teachers, who's a kind of master therapist named John Eisman, he said, in each moment, there is an organic impulse that's just coming out of our experience that is not related to conditioning, not related to doing so much. It's more like, what does the organism want in this moment? So tuning into that moment to moment is another way to practice. What is my authentic organic impulse? And what is my conditioning about, I need to do this or I need to do that? We can also really remember maybe some of the conditioning that we've had growing up. Because I think we also, when we look deeply, there are limiting beliefs about doing. How many of us got messages, don't be lazy, right? You will be rewarded if you are a good doer, right? And so that's another dimension that we can look into. Are there what we might call limiting beliefs? For me, I know I was a good doer and I got rewards. How many of us have got rewards for doing And how much is that really in the very structure of our being? In which activities can we find something beyond doing? In which activities, maybe, do we have more of a sense of flow and ease and receptivity? Maybe it's taking a hike. Maybe it's engaging in creative activities. Maybe art or poetry or music. Where do we find that sense of flow and something beyond the ordinary doer? So that points me to the last thing I want to bring up, and then we can open things up to talk together, is that I find that the path of practice points in different ways to a sense of non-doing as the most mature, most profound place of practice, we might say. And we find this in multiple traditions. It's probably most clearly expressed in the Taoist tradition. Many of you know the Taoist term in Chinese, wu wei, usually translated as non-action. And this is the ideal for Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. They take it as actually the most profound state. It's a way in which there can be what looks outwardly like doing, but it's coming out of a different inward place in which there's not a doing in the usual way. Let me just read a few passages to give you a taste of this. This is from Lao Tzu, the way of Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching. Tao invariably takes no action, and yet there is nothing left undone. For any of you who have copies of the Tao Te Ching at home, that's number 37. And then a second, number 48, the pursuit of learning is to increase day after day. The pursuit of Tao is to decrease day after day. It is a decrease and further decrease until one reaches the point of taking no action. No action is undertaken, and yet nothing is left undone. The same thing said. Nothing, there is non-doing, but nothing is left undone. I think it's what it's pointing to is a kind of doing, we might say, which comes out of non-doing, which comes out of a lack of that sense of the doer, which comes out of a deep, deep letting go. And again, it's interesting to ask ourselves, where do we find that kind of experience in ourselves? Which activities do we find that in? This is from Chuang Tzu, just I think a few hundred years later. Really, I'll read this in detail. This is called Action and Non-Action. The non-action, that's the wu wei, the non-action of the wise person is not inaction. Crucial. The non-action of the wise person is not inaction. It is not studied. It is not shaken by anything. The sage is quiet because the sage is not moved, not because one wills to be quiet. Still water is like glass. You can look in it and see the bristles on your chin. It is a perfect level. The heart of the wise person is tranquil. It is the mirror of heaven and earth, the glass of everything. Emptiness, stillness, tranquility, tastelessness, silence, non-action. This is the level of heaven and earth. This is perfect Tao. Wise ones find here their resting place, resting there empty. From emptiness comes the unconditioned. from this the condition, the individual things. From the sage's emptiness, stillness arises. From stillness, action. From action, attainment. From their stillness comes their non-action, which is also action, and is therefore their attainment. For stillness is joy. Joy is free from care, fruitful in long years. Joy does all things without concern. For emptiness, stillness, tranquility, tastelessness, silence, and non-action are the root of all things. And in some of the other stories in Chuang Tzu, there are stories of artists and craftspeople who get to that stage of non-doing and have amazing work that comes out of it. And I'll just mention maybe one other example, and then we can open things up. I mentioned some of the examples of that balance and not of doing and not doing in the teachings of the Buddha. There's also a strong emphasis on that in the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And I've been reading one of the great spiritual geniuses of all time named Longchenpa, who lived in the 14th century. And I think I'll just read maybe one or two passages which express something very similar. Awakened mind is by nature primordially pure. The true nature of phenomena is such that there is nothing to discard or adopt, nothing that comes or goes, nothing to achieve by trying. Let your mind and body relax deeply in a carefree state, with an easygoing attitude, like a person who has nothing to do. The final meditation instructions. Don't do anything, please. Interesting, right? That's what I was working with in the month of February and beyond. Let me see if I have another one. If you meditate again and again, this is also Longchenpa, if you meditate again and again, you will see that there is nothing to cultivate in meditation. Nothing to cultivate in meditation. This is the meditation of omnipresent awareness. And so actually, he's presupposing that one has actually done a lot of effort in the past to get to non-effort. He didn't say that there, but that's true. And maybe one last passage. This is from another text. Freedom is not due to effort. Rather, one abides timelessly in freedom. And so, something to experiment with in your meditation. Can we, maybe when the mind is somewhat quiet, can we let go of all effort, let go of all doing, but don't be distracted? Those are the instructions. When you get to a place where the mind's fairly settled, try for 5 minutes, let go of all doing, don't meditate in any conscious way, but don't be distracted. How does that sound? How many are already doing something that's in the territory? Something like that. Yeah, very good. Right. So that's the invitation for the next week, if you so choose, to explore your own relationship to doing. For some of us, it might be to develop that further, to open further to non-doing, receptivity, to inquire into the extent to which there are residues of the doer, strong or weak in your own experience. And then lastly, in meditation, have a period in which you let go of all doing and yet are still aware, not distracted. How many would like to explore one of those areas or more in the next week? Okay. Great. Great. Take some notes. We can come back and I'll go into go a little further, but especially we can talk together about the practices. So let me open it up right now, and I can't see everyone. I can see most people, so maybe use the raised hand function, or you can also, I don't know, could someone help look at the second screen? I can see everyone on the first screen if you want to raise your hand. Anyone like to, or maybe let me give just a few moments. Just why don't we have a few moments of silence? See what may have resonated with you from what I was exploring. And see whether there are any questions or anything you want to share. Take a minute or so right now to do that. Great. Let's start with Veda, please.
Thank you. You know, it sounds a lot easier than it is.
Right.
So I understand the concept, not that it's my reality, of being receptive in meditation.
Yeah.
When you say the doing in meditation, could you explain that a little? What is the doing in meditation?
Yeah. Yeah, so just in terms of, let's say we have half an hour meditation, different dimensions of doing. First is just to sit down and practice. That's a kind of a doing, right? Just to, literally to actually do it. So part of the doing is to actually engage in the practice. And then within the practice, let's say, whatever practice we're doing, but let's start with mindfulness. I mentioned that, and let's say we start with being with the breath, there's a doing that connects us over and over again with the breath. That's a kind of a doing. There's effort, in other words. We have to, say, let me connect, be with the breath, And then there may be a doing in noticing that we're distracted and coming back. There may be a doing in naming what's occurring if we're using the labeling method of mindfulness. There can be, if we get confused or stuck, we can ask ourselves, what should I do? And there's a kind of a doing that comes hopefully out of our wisdom. Oh, I'm really preoccupied by that interaction yesterday. What's a wise way to respond? That's a kind of a doing, right? And of course, that'll occur in the flow of daily life as well. So those are a few. Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is to let go of some of the doing and being receptive.
Well, I think it's up to each of us to see where we are with that balance. For some of us, in other words, that metaphor of the lute, too tight or too loose, where am I on that balance? If I'm too loose, it may be that more doing is called for. So it's going to be very individual. See where I am on that balance. And if I'm too loose, then we might say to ourselves, I really need to emphasize doing. And if I'm too tight, then I might let go of some of the doing and emphasize receptivity. And it can be really helpful to check in with that and set an intention at the beginning of a session.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Veda. Thank you. Good, we have Liz and then Patty.
Hi, Donald, thank you. You know this is my favorite topic lately.
Yeah.
I really love it. And for me, it's taken 25 years to get here. I think I told you that.
Yeah.
So as I said, I think this is a result from all my years of meditation, where last June on retreat, I finally let go. But it happened after many, many years of meditation experience. It's a maturity from all those years. And I think it involves faith, a word which I don't use very often. I think I prefer trust. Some people might use faith, but faith in the practice, trust in the practice, which has evolved over all these years. I think for me, a confusion may arise, and maybe this is for Vita also, in the term receptive. Because when you say receptive, my response to that is waiting to see what turns up. Now, I don't think that's what you're talking about, because then that would be insight meditation. I think for a lot of us also, the way we learned in insight meditation was a very strong doing, labeling. I'm beginning to teach mindfulness meditation, and I'm devastated with the program in a way, because it's so focused on rain, the rain practice. Now, that's a very strong doing. It's very psychologically oriented. It has nothing to do with what you're talking about. So I have to teach something and practice something else. That beginning practice does lead you to something else, but it's a beginning practice. And I don't want to be involved in the psychological analysis of my thoughts anymore. So I appreciate you're talking about this, because as I told you, I don't hear this from anybody. And in the program I'm in, it's so involved with doing. But all of us who learned originally in insight meditation, there was a very strong doing, labeling. This is what we learned. Over the years, if we stick with it, probably we learn, we do concentration practices, and we mature in the practice because we stay with it. As I said, this is, I don't think this is a practice for beginners. So again, this receptivity is where I'm confused about. To me, that's saying sitting and waiting for something to happen, and I'm not going to do that.
So a few things there. First of all, I think you're right to say that the main method of mindfulness practice coming from Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma, which emphasizes incessant labeling, is very much a doing practice. And it's actually important to open up further beyond that. I think I'd have to look carefully at this. I think in the stages of insight, some of the later stages might involve much less doing, but I'd have to check on that.
I'd like to know. Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be my guess. The other thing is that, there are a number of ways to practice. There is a dimension of the Mahasi method which involves non-doing, which is that there's something like what we sometimes call choiceless awareness.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we don't choose what to focus on. We focus on whatever's predominant. Now, that involves a dimension of receptivity, because I'm not, you know, I choose maybe initially to be with the breath, but then I let whatever is predominant be what I focus on. That is a dimension of receptivity. Mm-hmm. But further, I think what I'm pointing to is, let's say that body sensations are predominant. Receptivity would mean just sitting back and noticing the sensations without trying to control them at all or make anything happen. And there's a dimension of receptivity there, the same way that if we could be receptive with a sunset, we're just there receiving the sensations of the visual sensations, let's say. So that's a dimension of receptivity. And maybe lastly, just to say that even in the rain method, under investigation, there are going to be some receptive dimensions there. It's not, at least the way I would teach it, it's not particularly focused psychologically, that investigation would mean, you know, it's like, if I have a lot of anger, it'd be like, okay, let me just see what's the anger like. And I have to sit back and watch it. I'm angry for 10 minutes in a row. Oh, what's there? Oh, what's it like in the body? And there's a aspect of receptivity there. And that's investigation. You know, oh, what's the narrative? Let me just see what it is. You know, maybe there's a balance of doing because we're noticing, but there's also receptivity, or let me notice what happens when anger shifts. Oh, it's shifting to sadness. That involves receptivity, not structuring my experience. So I think even in an investigation, there are receptive dimensions.
Thank you. I'll think about it.
Yeah, thanks for the questions, Liz. Great.
Yeah, I'm so involved with whole body breathing and when I meditate now, I'm so aware of my whole body. And that's all I'm feeling and thinking about and being present with that.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me go to Patty and then Corey, and then we'll come to our closing because we're getting a little bit over time. So Patty and then Corey.
Yeah. Hi, Donald. Thank you for this. I'm a little confused, and your answer to Viva confused me more. I mean, your answer to Liz confused me a little more. I can't see how being aware is non-doing, because when I'm sitting in choiceless awareness, or if I'm sitting trying to do nothing, what comes into my awareness is sort of focusing my brain on it. I'm sort of like, oh, now I'm aware. I do this a lot with physical sensations when I have body pain. I try to rest in the awareness of the pain rather than get lost in the pain itself.
Yeah.
I feel the awareness, but that feels more like a doing than a being.
Yeah, well, there can be a kind of a mixture. When we have a kind of choiceless awareness, there's a dimension of receptivity or non-doing there. We let occur whatever is occurring. That's a dimension of non-doing. But then if I focus on it, if I focus my attention on the awareness of it, or if I just try to stay with what's there, that's a kind of a doing. So we can have both doing and receptivity at the same time.
Thank you. But is there any way to only do the being and not the... In other words, during your talk, I thought there was a way to sort of abandon the doing and rest in the being.
Yeah. There are progressive stages. Maybe I'll talk more about that next time. But just very, very briefly, there are ways that when the mind is very, very stable, we can have a choiceless awareness in which just one thing, often it's things are coming very, very quickly, and we can have a stage where we're not choosing what happens. Things are happening very quickly, but I'm still tracking them. So there's a kind of a doing. And then at a certain point, we can let go of the intention to track. And that can open up into a larger awareness where there's no conscious attempt to do.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. And that's what I'm taking on as an assignment, because I can't envision it, but I want to try it.
Yeah, it generally requires a significant level of stability. And then there are also, you know, there are also other practices. Essentially, let me back up. There is a kind of a very open, spacious awareness which doesn't have the subject-object duality. We call that sometimes awakened awareness or spacious awareness or non-dual awareness. And we can access that in countless ways. What I just mentioned is one way to access it. And we can access it in other ways, sometimes just by the invitation, let go. Sometimes the mind can just go there. So there are different access routes, and I'll go into that more next time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And last person, Corey, please.
Great. I'm just going to read a question that was in the chat, Donald.
Okay, great.
But I have to say that this reminds me of non-duality.
Non-duality. That's good. Never thought of that.
Vivian asks in the chat, awakening is at the end of my to-do list. I find non-doing very boring. How can I cultivate interest in non-doing or boredom?
How can I cultivate interest in non-doing or boredom?
Right.
Okay. I Read a lot of Lao Tzu or Chuang Tzu. It's one way. Probably, I would say, look into your own experiences of non-doing, because they probably are some of the most precious experiences of your life, actually. You know, when have you just had a sense that I don't need to do anything, I am just being? So we can use the language of being and doing and saying, when were you experiencing beingness without doing? And look into those experiences, reflect on them. I imagine they're some of the most precious experiences of one's life, whether it's immersion in the mountains or the forest, or being in a state of love with another being where there was nothing at all to do, just resting in being with this other one. You know, that would be a kind of non-doing that's very precious. So I think looking into those experiences and just seeing also how they may be occurring in very ordinary ways. When you really just relax with the sunset, there's a kind of non-doing. So that'd be for the first part. And then this is more advanced practice, but if you really are interested in boredom, you can bring investigation to it. Notice when you're bored and then say, what's happening now? What's the wanting? What do I really want? What would really satisfy me now? And see what that's about. But I think probably my first response is probably more promising, because the language of non-doing or non-action isn't flashy, we might say. You know, it doesn't come with a lot of immediate advertising. And so I'm hoping to spark people's interest by pointing to some of the profundity of it.